The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Good evening, and welcome to The Business of Giving. I'm your host, Denver Frederick, and we have another interesting show on tap for you this evening. My first guest has spent her entire life around the world of philanthropy. She is Peggy Dulaney, the daughter of David Rockefeller, and the founder and chair of Synergos. She believes that for an individual to truly be effective in solving complex social problems, they must first look inside.
In my thinking, this process of looking inward, being in the context of a safe group, etc., taking a pause, leads us not only to be more present, not only more loving, but almost everybody wants to serve after this. It's almost the automatic output of healing yourself. You want to give that back to the world.
And then I will be joined by Joel Rose, the CEO of New Classrooms. What they're about is personalized learning and meeting each student where they are. This model addresses the kind of problems he encountered when he was a teacher.
I remember my principal knocked on my door and he gave me a stack of papers that showed me the incoming test scores of the kids in my class. And there were some coming in at a third grade level, some at an eighth grade level, and everything in between. Then he gave me a set of fifth grade math textbooks and he said, good luck. And as crazy as that sounds, that happens in schools all across the country and frankly around the world. We've got students who have all the unique needs and a teacher that can only teach one thing at a time.
But first, the Business Giving News Digest for Sunday, January 27th. A report released this week by Oxfam, the UK poverty relief and philanthropic group, states that just 26 individuals account for as much wealth as the world's 3.8 billion poorest people. Following China's ban on ivory last year, supported by 90% of the Chinese people, ivory demand has dropped by almost half, and poaching rates are falling in places like Kenya. The University of Virginia has announced a $120 million gift from the Quantitative Foundation to establish a school of data science. And the Rockefeller Foundation and the MasterCard Center for Inclusive Growth have announced a five-year, $50 million commitment in support of socially focused data science initiative. Niger revealed that thousands of local farmers have planted more than 200 million trees in the past three decades, the largest positive transformation of the environment in African history. Online giving to colleges, universities, and schools was up 27% in 2018 over the previous year. December's online fundraising was particularly robust, with those institutions raising 48% more than in December of 2017. Human trafficking has become such a danger in California that San Diego County has made it a part of the curriculum at seven local school districts. And Google's philanthropic arm, Google.org, has launched a new program that will pay its employees to do pro bono work for nonprofit groups for up to 6 months. And finally, when it comes to diversity among environmental organizations, many come up against the so-called green ceiling. And here from the Chronicle Philanthropy to discuss that with us is Julian Wiley. Good evening, Julian.
Hi, thank you for having me, Denver.
One of the reports that recently came out was issued by the independent advocacy group Green 2.0. What were some of their key findings?
Well, they looked into nonprofits and foundations in two respects, mainly to figure out if there was any decreases or increases in diversity among a gender basis and also from people of color. What they sort of found was that nonprofits and foundations, some of them did better than others, but overall there was the sense that women and people of color were kind of losing ground in terms of diversity at some of these environmentally focused groups.
Mm-hmm. Would you say that environmental organizations, by and large, are behind other groups in the nonprofit sector when it does come to diversity, equity, and inclusion?
No, I definitely wouldn't say that. I think that generally this is a reflection of the nonprofit sector as a whole, foundations included. I think what their report was sort of gearing into was the idea about This is important for environmental groups, mainly because this is a social issue that affects everybody, regardless of their social standing, their nationality, all different kinds of ways that we see diversity today. So mainly what they were looking into is, if environmental organizations want to say, hey, we want to help different people from different backgrounds, you also need to employ these people as well, because maybe they bring different perspectives to the workplace.
Yeah, and they were pretty critical of a number of organizations that had not fully reported the data as they saw that it should have been reported, correct?
Yes. Mainly they were particularly critical of Pew Charitable Trust and Oceana. They did speak of others, but that was two of the groups that they specifically called incredibly bad actors. I ended up speaking to Whitney Tome, who's the executive director of Green 2.0, and she kind of told me that her main critique of Pew Charitable Trust in particular is that the Pew brand is sort of known as this research group that looks into other organizations. They request data. They get different information from other groups. Yet from her critique, it's that Pew wasn't necessarily being forthcoming with them, even though that they've reached out to a lot of these groups since 2015. So that was kind of where the rift began, is sort of this back and forth of, we want to get the data, but then certain groups just did not want to give their data. And to be clear, Pew and Oceana were not the only ones that didn't give stuff over to the advocacy group.
Yeah, got you. Finally, Julian, are there steps that some environmental organizations are taking to build a more diverse workforce and board?
Yeah, definitely. There was talks about, in a conference call to media, there was representatives from Sierra Club that mentioned there were different things that they wanted to do to be able to increase staff diversity and also just increase, make their programs better. Sierra Club kind of mentioned this example of trying to reach out to a different base of people of color. They were looking into trying to get more Hispanics involved, Latino-based people. And what they mainly found is that a lot of their promotional material just didn't include real people. There are very staged photos, staged marketing material. So then they looked into, well, let's actually sponsor some trips where we get real photos, real people doing real programs with Sierra Club, and they found it to be a really successful program. So mainly it was just the idea that if you do little things to reach out, small investments, they would reap big rewards as far as trying to increase diversity among your workforce, but also bringing more brand awareness to your particular nonprofit.
Absolutely, step by step. Well, thanks, Julian, for this report. It was good to have you on the show.
No problem. Thank you so much for the time.
I'll be back with more of The Business of Giving right after this.
The Business of Giving is pleased to feature news correspondents every week from the Chronicle of Philanthropy, a trusted source of daily news on the nonprofit world. A subscription to The Chronicle gets you instant access to practical online tools like checklists, resource guides, and expert advice, and in-depth insight into the big ideas and trends that are transforming the nonprofit world. Learn more at philanthropy.com. That's The Chronicle of Philanthropy at philanthropy.com. Do you know someone who's dealing with a serious illness or injury? Researchers at Kessler Foundation in West Orange, New Jersey, are studying new treatments for people with brain injury, breast cancer, multiple sclerosis, osteoarthritis, and spinal cord injury. They need volunteers with these conditions, as well as healthy volunteers to serve as controls. To learn more, call Kessler Foundation at 844-KF-STUDY. That's 844-KF-STUDY. A simple smile can say so much. It can say thank you, please, or even I love you. Sometimes a smile can say more than words could ever express. But what if you couldn't smile? Unfortunately, that's the sad reality for so many children today. Without the help of life-saving surgery, helpless children find themselves cast aside and all alone. But it doesn't have to be this way. To learn how you can help Smile Train, the world's largest cleft charity, change the world one smile at a time, go to smiletrain.org. The Nature Conservancy believes in a world where nature and people can thrive together. Visit nature.org now to learn more about how you can be our partner. If you're interested in reading transcripts of guests' interviews from The Business of Giving, you can find them at denverfrederick.wordpress.com. And now back to the show on AM 970, The Answer.
There are many organizations that are dedicated to and possess great expertise in areas such as education, health, fresh water, agriculture, and a host of other issues. But there are very few whose expertise is problem solving, convening, facilitating, and getting people to work together in such a way that it makes a significant difference in the lives of those they are seeking to serve. One of the most exceptional and thoughtful of all of these is Synergos, and it's a great pleasure to have with us their founder and chair, Peggy Delaney. Good evening, Peggy, and welcome to the Business of Giving.
Good evening, and thanks so much.
Tell us a little bit more about Synergos, Peggy, the mission of the organization, and what it was created to do.
The mission is to enable people to solve problems sustainably, particularly around poverty, the environment, etc., but by using methods that allow them to bring their best selves to the table and work collaboratively to do so.
The first seeds for Synergos may have taken root when you worked in a squatter settlement in Brazil as a teenager. Tell us about that experience and the impact that it had on you.
Well, I had the opportunity to live during 3 summers in Brazil, and I wanted to do something, quote, useful, which at the age of 17, 18, and 19 is not so easy.
Yeah, a little hazy.
But I ended up working with an anthropologist and a group of diverse people in several favelas to try to understand what it was that enabled people who'd moved from rural areas to the urban areas to adapt and survive, actually, because it was very, very difficult. And that left me with the distinct impression that those who are facing problems related to poverty have the greatest will and desire to overcome them. But as long as we have only top-down solutions or no policies that help them, then that will has a ceiling. It can't go beyond a certain point. So I was simply left with the impression that we need to have connections vertically and horizontally in order for people to be able to solve serious problems related to poverty.
Well, those are powerful seeds. There's no question about it, because the way Synergos has bloomed really does come from that sensibility you had during those 3 summers. Give us an idea of some of the problems that the organization works on and what parts of the world those might be in.
Well, until quite recently, a large part of our focus was in both forming networks so that we would have the capacity to do the convening and find the right people to work together in many different countries around the world. And so I'll give you one example. In Maharashtra, India, a number of years ago, we worked with the collaboration and support initially of UNICEF and Unilever and Genron, another convening organization and facilitating, to reduce childhood stunting in the state of Maharashtra, which has 100 million people. I won't go into the details of the process now, but the end result, after a long process of building trust across stakeholder groups where there was no trust and no love lost, was that the rate of childhood stunting of children under 5 went down from 39% to 23%, which really gave us the confidence that the approach we were developing and learning was actually going to work.
Yeah, that's the first place you really got traction on that approach.
That's right.
And now you've tried it in so many different parts of the world. Mm-hmm. You know it's not specific to any one particular area. There are some universal truths.
That is correct, although, of course, there are cultural differences and one has to adapt.
Well, systems change, and that's what you've done, requires collaboration, because people and organizations who are going it alone, they can have some impact, but it's always going to be quite limited. But we know collaboration just doesn't happen by getting people into a room together, although I think a lot of people think that's the way it goes. It really is a lot of hard work. You have egos, you have logos, you have different views of the world. Tell us about the Synergos approach and how you are very intentional about that process.
So I should begin by saying that this four-pronged approach has developed over 32 years. It was not easy to come to, and we kept adding things as we realized that we were falling short. But what we finally came to was that unless you take an inclusive, collaborative approach, and by inclusive I mean not just the powers that be, but also including those who are affected by whatever problem it is that that particular country has chosen to work on, you won't get a sustainable solution. So the core of the approach that we have been using and now are hoping to spread by building capacity and others to use it is inclusive collaboration. But beyond that, we realize that unless the stakeholders, who probably don't trust each other because trust has broken down all over the world, mm-hmm. are brought together in ways in which they come to perceive where each of them is coming from, then you won't be able to build that trust. So, for example, and this is part of the systems thinking that we use as a tool, we take the group in a diverse form on learning journeys to look at the nature of the problem. And after spending 5 days together, and you might have a community activist, a government person, a business person, et cetera, they begin to see more through the same lens because they understand each other's perspective. They may not end up totally agreeing, mm-hmm. but they will begin to understand the rationale and the feelings behind the other's perception. So that both builds trust, but it also gives you a system-wide perception of what the problem is. And then once you have that trust, you can begin to generate consensus and rapid prototyping to get to really creative ideas to solve the problem. Mm-hmm. So that's one, the systems thinking. Secondly, we realized that there's a type of leadership that really helps this happen. We call it bridging leadership, and that's become the core of what we do and what we believe is necessary to build trust and solve problems in the world. So bridging leaders are people who have the ability to reach out across divides while not losing touch and credibility with their own constituency. But as we began to notice these people and, in fact, research what were the key characteristics, one of which is deep listening, the ability to put yourself in other people's shoes, to empathize with others, and to dialogue with those with different perceptions. Once we realized that, then we realized, so why aren't more people bridging leaders? What is it that, what are the obstacles, even with the good bridging leaders, that get in the way of their actually being able to do this empathic listening, convening, et cetera? And we realized that a lot of it relates to, I'll use the dramatic word, trauma. Anything that might have happened from early childhood on that puts one in a state of fear or shame or rage or grief. All of those are ways that people then come to protect themselves. And if I can use a non-scientific word, protect their hearts.
Yeah.
In a way, to be a good bridging leader, you have to have your heart open mm-hmm. as well as your ears open. And so then we began the fourth pillar, which was the inner work, to help those stakeholders begin to step back from their busy lives, which is very hard if you're a corporate CEO or a government
or anybody,
minister or
a,
an activist. Yeah. But to do that in such a way that they begin to recognize at least, you never get over the total trauma, but if you begin to recognize the triggers and you can then step aside from it, then you become a better listener, a more empathic person, able to approach the world more with your heart open and your ears open.
Yeah. Let me touch on some of those things, and that was a wonderful overview. Thank you for that. Let's talk a little bit about listening, because I don't think that everybody thinks they're a pretty good listener, but they're really not. As a matter of fact, when I go to a lot of these seminars and things, they'll have the 6 points, and listening will be point number two or point number three, and everybody just skips over it because they're a good listener, and they're not. You were one of the organizations, one of the first, to recognize the importance of listening to those people who are closest to the problem. What does make for a good, deep, active listener?
Well, the easiest way to see it is that you don't have 100 other things running around in the back of your mind.
Fully present.
Yeah, fully mm-hmm. present.
Yeah,
is
I got you.
That, and also that you feel secure in yourself so that you're not constantly thinking of what you're going to say next or what's your next question. You're actually really focusing on what that person is saying and then allowing the next step to come up. But that really does mean being present and being calm.
Mm-hmm. And trusting yourself.
Trusting
that
yourself.
That it will come.
Very
that
important.
That it's somewhere inside of you, and also that the people you're talking to, the answer is really inside of them.
Yeah,
and
very much.
And it's best for you just to try to bring it out and be a facilitator, but not to try to dictate it to them. You know, you talk about the inner work, and one piece of that is the shadow that is attached to each of us. What is this shadow, and where in the world did it come from?
Mm-hmm. Well, of course, there are many ways of describing it and many theories, but I'll give you mine,
mm-hmm.
which isn't that I invented it. It's what I've taken from various pieces of literature. So when we're – usually when we're young, something happens. A parent, a caretaker, a teacher will tell us something that in our young ears we hear as you are bad, not just this is a bad or dangerous thing, you shouldn't be doing it. So we internalize that judgment about ourselves and, of course, try not to repeat that behavior for the most part. But what ends up happening is that internalization takes a lot of energy to keep down. Let's say we're a very energetic young child and we love running around and putting our fingers in electric sockets and all of this, and we get that repeated feedback. We try to stop it because the people on who we depend for our lives when we're very young children are telling us we're bad. Mm-hmm. So it takes quite a bit of energy if we're an energetic child, and even if we're not, to hold that down. And we tend to do that our entire lives until we begin to look at it. So not only are we repressing a vital energy in ourselves, but it turns out, and this is the best way to find out what your shadow is, think of the person who triggers you the most and what that behavior is. So if you think of that and then you think, ugh, which, you know, the first time someone – you're really on to something. And, I mean, I'll just give my own example.
Please,
I think it helps with a story. So my mother had six children. Mm-hmm. It was more than she could manage. And we were all energetic. And she couldn't stand our taking center stage, talking too much, et cetera. So my protection became to be relatively mute, not talk too much, not take the center stage. So when I see someone who's doing that, it makes me so mad. And I have to recognize, okay, that's what I really wanted to do and I wasn't allowed to. That's a piece of my shadow. Mm-hmm. And coming to realize that this is something that happened very young.
Yeah.
We were not bad. We were just children. Mm-hmm. And coming to accept where the roots of that are and that actually – if we can free up that energy, even though it may at first come out a little abruptly, that we're going to have so much positive energy for the rest of our lives. So it takes practice.
Yeah, I bet it does. Because I can see, I mean, that was a great point of how you identify the mm-hmm. shadow. But then how does somebody learn to accept that that is, in fact, part of them?
Yeah. So this is really where the inner work comes on.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's related to the results of trauma, the guilt, rage, shame, fear, etc. And I didn't mean to say guilt. I meant to see – although that's another factor. I meant to say grief.
Mm-hmm.
But the relationship is that if we don't have the space to go in and examine, to step back and allow ourselves the opportunity to let this come up in a guided way – it's very difficult to do this completely by yourself.
I bet, yeah.
But so this is why we do groups, mm-hmm. both in the partnerships that we create. We do groups with the stakeholders, although we don't go quite as far as we do on the wilderness retreat groups. And because in getting the feedback, the immediate feedback within a safe container, within a group, both builds trust, which is so fundamental for everything, mm-hmm. allows ourselves to be vulnerable and to really feel the cost of what it is that we've been holding back or letting out all these years. And then other people begin to admire the one who exhibits that, and they see, oh my gosh, this is actually okay, this is safe. And then a sense of belonging comes, and from there you go on to creativity and being able to be more present.
Yeah, and I know there's it's so important to accept that part of you. It's not a bad part of you. There's no judgment that you should pass on it. It is just part of you.
Yeah.
And it's neutral in that sense of the word, and you need to listen to it.
Yeah.
And I guess in that sense, your greatest trauma could also be your greatest gift if you can identify
Absolutely.
It.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I've said that many times. I use the word wound, you
mm-hmm.
know. And if you can, it really does allow you to open up so much more.
What do you think stops us from being our best selves?
Well, fear, shame, grief, rage, mm-hmm. and the fear of its implication. You know, with most of us, with our shadow, we'll do things that it was like, oh my gosh, that wasn't me. Like, we'll explode at somebody in a way that really the situation didn't merit.
Yeah.
That's the leaking out of the shadow.
Hmm.
And until we can recognize where it's coming from and why that got triggered, and by the way, it'll probably always get triggered a bit. So we have to kind of go back to the beginning, witness it in ourselves, step aside, recognize what happened, and then go on again.
Yeah.
But
it's like going off a diet. Just don't go on a binge. Just take a step back and start up again.
Yeah, right.
So, you know, you talked a little bit about hitting the pause button. Because, you know, we live in a society where achievement is celebrated. The more you can achieve in the less amount of time, it's celebrated even more. Mm-hmm. And if you do it without sleeping, you're a superhero.
Mm.
But you really believe that hitting that pause button and reflecting is so important. What happens when you take the time to do that?
Well, most of us don't until we burn out or break down or get sick. First of all, that's reality for many people, unless there's some lucky people who have a calm personality. They don't overdo it. They maybe start meditating early in life,
mm-hmm.
you know. So I'm not talking about every single person, but most activists, most executives, most government officials just do it. The same happened to me after 13 years of trying to put Synergos together. And I moved to Montana. I took a sabbatical. And during that time, I began to, as I was hiking and skiing in the woods or riding behind cows or whatever, it gave a space in the context of the beauty of the natural world, which allowed me really to forgive myself, which is another important thing. Usually we blame ourselves for all of this.
You're right.
And it also allowed me to get a good night's sleep for several months. Which is another key factor. You mentioned lack of sleep. I mean, we are not our full selves when we're living in an exhausted state. So it really begins that we find a place, and not everybody would like to be in the remote mountains of Montana,
mm-hmm.
or can be. So the question is, how can other people who don't have that liberty find the way with other people or alone to take that pause and just give themselves the reflection? Some people find it in religious services.
Yeah.
You know, that gives them great confidence and a feeling of safety. Others find it in meditation. Others in exercise, running, yoga, etc.
You're yoga, right?
I do mm-hmm. yoga, yes, and that really helps.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there are lots of ways of going about it. Not everyone needs to take a full sabbatical to make it happen. But if you really have burned out, you may not have a choice or your health may be at stake.
When you've seen people who have done this inner work and then come together with others who have as well to try to tackle one of these really complex social problems,
mm-hmm.
what's the difference that you've seen compared to the normal way we've gone about doing our business?
Yeah, it's a great question. In my thinking, this process of looking inward, being in the context of a safe group, et cetera, taking a pause, leads us not only to be more present, not only more loving, but almost everybody wants to serve after this. It's almost the automatic output of healing yourself. You want to give that back to the world. So if people start with that desire to serve, and usually humility comes along with going through the process, so you're not so full of ego or competitiveness or whatever, then you're starting at such a great place because you're open. And hopefully you find or help get other people open. And then the possibilities are endless for collaboration and results.
Yeah, when you show a little vulnerability, everybody else feels it's safe for them. And
that's
particularly
right.
When the leader does that in an organization.
Yeah,
yeah, I can't think of anything that's much more powerful than that. I know you go about your work and do a lot of it through networks.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us a little bit about those networks and how they've been utilized to help solve some of these problems.
Yeah, well, I can give three examples of networks that we've been engaged with for many years. One is called the Senior Fellows,
mm-hmm.
and that's now about 150 senior civil society leaders from 50 countries. So we have people who have gained trust among themselves and with us, who are all serving, some of them more or less with love, and are very talented individuals that we can call on. And there so far has never been a country that we've been asked to do something in that we couldn't, through our network, find good people in that country. So that's invaluable.
Yeah.
Secondly, a number of years ago, we began to realize that the kind of work we were doing wasn't the type of work that people in a position to be donors, philanthropists, either institutional or individual or foundations, were funding. And it occurred to us that if we could, first of all, create a peer learning network of philanthropists from around the world, both in the northern and southern hemisphere, do the same thing we've just been talking about, create trust among them so that they really are open to learning from each other substantively, culturally, in other ways, that they would also be thinking in a way more of serving with love, rather than just how can I apply the 1% or 5% of whatever the money I have to give away in the most strategic way. But usually that strategic way is measured in terms of, you know, measurable outcomes of reduced deaths or illness or whatever, all extremely valuable. But the sustainability of those solutions is probably not going to be there unless these other things, the building of trust, the bringing people together, the helping them become better bridging leaders, including the philanthropists mm-hmm. and the organizations they fund. So we started this Global Philanthropist Circle, which now has about 100 families from about 35 countries. And again, it just feels like a miracle every time they get together.
Yeah.
Because especially those that participate enough, they really love meeting with each other. Some of them have been on these retreats together. And it becomes more and more creative, and they create their own affinity groups, whether it's about refugees or shifting the food system or what we call a spiritual civilization. They create it because those are common interests across people from different countries. And then the third I would just mention is that in the MENA region, the Middle East, North Africa region, we found a great need for what we call social entrepreneurs. There's a huge lack of employment. Mm-hmm. Especially youth employment. And so we have a program that forms a network of people who are needing employment to learn from others who are mentors, maybe who've been doing it for longer, how to create their own employment, how to use their creativity to figure out how to get things done. And that has also been hugely enriching in what's otherwise a troubled as well as extremely creative area.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit more about philanthropy. Being the daughter of David Rockefeller, you have spent your entire life around philanthropy and service, and it's probably something that was talked about around the dinner table all the time. Looking just sort of on the macro, beyond your network, which is so effective, how do you think philanthropy could be utilized more effectively?
Well, it's a good question, and there are, of course, many different answers mm-hmm. to that, so I don't pretend to have the one. But very often, people who come into money, either they make it or they inherit it, philanthropy kind of reaches their radar screen because they hear that other people are doing it or they think they should do it or they really want to do it. But not everybody has the opportunity to get, I don't really like to use the word trained, but have their capacity built, all the principles I'm just talking about.
Yeah.
As well as more skill-based things of how to measure impact and all of that. And there are wonderful programs that do that and wonderful ways that bring both young and other philanthropists together so that they will have the impact that they want and they'll realize what their passion is and they'll apply not only their money, I always make this point, but their skills, their connections, their influence, everything and everything they have to bring to bear together on the issues around which they feel most passionate.
The totality of who they are.
Right.
Otherwise, the money is very antiseptic.
It can be.
It can be. It's just, you write a check, it's not the same thing. You know, the corporate culture at Synergos is so much admired. What are a couple of things you believe, Peggy, that are vital to a healthy and vibrant workplace culture, and how do they manifest themselves at Synergos?
Well, I should start by saying that we're not perfect.
that's actually a pretty good start.
Yeah, and that we've been through a number of iterations that I think all activists and passionate people face, which is we get so caught up in the work that we're doing that we often don't stop to breathe, to stretch, to meditate, to just socialize with each other.
Mm-hmm.
So we're really working on creating a culture that allows for that and encourages it and offers the opportunity for people within the organization or outside to take time to really devote themselves to improving themselves in the sense of becoming better bridging leaders themselves.
Mm-hmm. Let me close with this, Peggy. We have lost trust. We've lost trust in our institutions, our religious institutions, a lot of our businesses, the media, in each other. What can we as a society do to regain that trust?
So I would apply that globally,
yeah,
because it's not just in the United States, and it's also between the United States and other countries. We do quite a lot of work in China, and a lot of it has to do with building relationships between mostly business and some civil society leaders in China and some of our members of our networks from other countries. Because I believe that across countries, it's at least equally important to build that kind of trust. And you have to do it almost one person or one group at a time.
Hmm.
And, you know, there are remarkable organizations in this country that are trying to do that across the political divides, across the economic divides. There are people, I think, who are increasingly recognizing that this has to be a piece of everything we do. It's not just solving a pollution problem or a poverty problem. The context in which it's done and bringing all the stakeholders together in a way that builds that trust as a basis, not just an endpoint, but a basis for then coming up with the most creative solutions.
Well, Peggy Delaney, the founder and chair of Synergos, I want to thank you so much for being here this evening. Tell us about your website and some of the information that listeners will find if they come visit.
Thank you. Our website is www.synergos.org, and we would welcome people to visit it, to get in touch with us. If you want to get involved, we can find ways to help you get involved. And thank you so much, Denver.
Oh, my pleasure. And you got some great information there, including some of the papers you've written on that inner work, which I really found to be fantastic. It was a real pleasure to have you on the show, Peggy.
Thanks so much.
I'll be back with more of The Business of Giving right after this.
Tiana was homeless and looking for a change when she found Year Up. Like many in her community, she was smart and talented, but didn't have the same opportunities as others. At Year Up, she gained valuable skills and experience, entering the healthcare IT field upon graduation. Year Up is a transformative opportunity for motivated young adults and companies looking for talent. 85% of alumni are employed or in school within 4 months of graduation. Support young adults like Tiana. Visit yearup.org.
Before you give to charity, go to charitynavigator.org. Charity Navigator provides free ratings of thousands of America's largest charities, helping you get the most out of your charitable dollar. Charitynavigator.org, your guide to intelligent giving.
Technology can change lives, but underserved communities around the world have yet to experience all the benefits technology offers. Benetech is a nonprofit whose mission is to empower communities in need by creating scalable technology solutions. Their work has transformed how 500,000 people with disabilities access information, made it easier and safer for human rights defenders to document violations, and equipped environmental conservationists to protect ecosystems. Learn more by visiting Benetech.org.
Well, my husband is a retired sergeant from the Air Force.
Well, he was in the Army for 14 years and an MP.
23 million veterans, they're heroes who need our help.
Well, I'm here because my daughter has had her third surgery for cancer.
We've had some difficulties, so we're here quite some time. We're going on to 3 weeks.
When our heroes' families need help, they turn to Fisher House.
We learned about the Fisher House through the doctor, and we were so grateful because who has 3 weeks to be able to come and stay at a hotel?
Fisher House is a safe, free place to stay for families of wounded warriors and veterans receiving treatment at VA and military medical centers.
Fisher House is not only a home away from home, it was like family away from family.
Thank you, Fisher House.
Thank you, Fisher House.
Helping military and veterans families. Fisher House at fisherhouse.org. Sometimes having family close by is a hero's best medicine.
Follow the Business of Giving on Twitter at BizOfGive and at Facebook.com/BusinessOfGiving. And now, back to the Business of Giving with your host, Denver Frederick, on AM 970, The Answer.
We live in an era of personalization. When we go to Amazon, it has our profile, our history, and makes recommendations of what we might want to buy. Spotify knows what we've listened to and serves up new songs we almost certainly like. And the excitement in the field of health these days is around personalized medicine. So what's happening in the field of education? Well, some neat stuff like Teach to One Math. And here to tell us about it is Joel Rose, the co-founder and CEO of New Classrooms. Good evening, Joel, and welcome to the Business of Giving.
Thanks, Denver, for having me.
If you would begin by giving us a distinction between New Classrooms and Teach to One Math, and then tell us what the organization was created to do.
Sure. New Classrooms is a nonprofit organization committing to reimagine the classroom. We create totally different learning models, totally different classroom experiences. The first one we've created is called Teach to One Math, and it's effectively a program that schools across the country, public schools, district schools, charter schools, independent schools, can adopt as their core or supplemental math program.
Well, this is all around personalized learning. And at times it seems that everyone has their own definition of what that is. How would you define personalized learning?
Personalized learning is really about tailoring each student's experience to their specific strengths and needs and giving students ownership over their own learning.
Mm-hmm. You were a classroom teacher. I think it was fifth grade, if I'm right.
That's right.
Were the seeds of personalized learning approach planted then, or did they come a little bit later on?
No question. Even from my very first week on the job, I remember my principal knocked on my door and he gave me a stack of papers that showed me the incoming test scores of the kids in my class. And there were some coming in at a third grade level, some at an eighth grade level, and everything in between. Then he gave me a set of fifth grade math textbooks and he said, good luck. And as crazy as that sounds, that happens in schools all across the country and frankly around the world. We've got students who have all the unique needs and a teacher that can only teach one thing at a time.
Well, back in 2008, you were overseeing the Human Resources Department for the Department of Education here in New York City. How did you go from there, Joel, to developing this concept and what ultimately became New Classrooms?
So when I was working in HR, I took our HR team to go visit HR departments at places like IBM and GE just to see how do they actually manage people. There are great people who work for city governments. They've oftentimes worked there for their entire career. We had always talked about the four R's, which was recruit, retain, remediate, and in some cases, remove. But those organizations talked about five R's. And the fifth R they talked about that we never talked about was role. Are you designing jobs that are doable? And I thought a lot about my own experience as a teacher and how I'm not so sure I was set up for success given the variability in the classroom from the very first day.
How did you get this started? I think Joel Klein then was running the show.
Exactly. So a little bit later, I was visiting a friend of mine who runs an adult learning center. And when I walked in, there was a big sign in the lobby. And the sign said, choose your modality. You can learn live, you can learn online, or do sort of a blend. And I thought, wow, that's fascinating. Maybe one of the ways to sort of deal with the problem I dealt with as a teacher was have different modalities, have live teacher-led instruction, kids working collaboratively, kids working online, all in the same room, and somehow use technology to organize all that. So I got excited about this idea. At the time, I called it School of One. And I wrote it up into a big proposal document and shared it with the chancellor, and he got pretty excited by it. We raised a little bit of money, and we got it off the ground.
Mm-hmm. And he came to visit that summer, right?
Five times, actually.
Mm-hmm.
He brought the state commissioner. He brought the mayor. He brought Jeb Bush. Anyone who he could bring to actually show them what the power of this was. He was our biggest champion.
What made you decide to move it outside of New York City and make it a national organization?
Sure. Well, there were a couple reasons. One was, we thought there would likely be a time, there would be a time when the mayor was no longer the mayor, and there'd be a new mayor who'd come in who might say, this was the last guy's idea and might kill it. And I didn't
Excellent
know that I wanted
point.
To take that risk. And then the second reason, though, is we're living at a time where when you think about the power of technology and the scalability of technology, you sort of build something once, you build it right, and then it can scale. There's not like Facebook LA and Facebook New York and Facebook Miami. There's Facebook.
Yeah.
And so I thought, if we could really build this once and build it right, it could impact far more kids than just those in New York City.
Yeah, and when you think about a program like this, Joel, you're always thinking about the academic design. But you found out pretty early on that operational design was every bit as important. Tell us how you altered that and made that to make this a rich experience.
Sure. So when you're really thinking about the classroom experience, there are certain elements around learning progressions and skill maps and content and assessment and all the things you'd expect to see in any classroom. But to really make this work, you also have to think about things like, where do kids put their backpacks?
Mm.
What if there's a substitute teacher one day? How does grading work? How does homework work? Because you can't just put the burden of all those logistics on the individual teacher to figure out for themselves. And so when we've thought about the design of Teach to One, it's not only the academic components, but it's all those logistical components that really are the difference between a good program and a great program.
Yeah. And I suspect you probably debated whether you should be making this a for-profit or a nonprofit organization when you started. And you chose the latter. Why was that the case?
Well, as I went out and talked to folks about this, a couple of things I learned. Number one, there are many venture capitalists, if not most, dare I say, that want nothing to do with the K-12 sector. There's 15,000 fragmented and sometimes resistant to change, no, not always, school districts. And there have not been a lot of success in venture-funded educational companies because of the nature of the marketplace itself. It's just not conducive to rapid scale. So while I thought we might be able to raise some money, I wasn't so sure we could actually succeed for the long haul. We always thought we needed high levels of R&D investment to get this right in a market that was probably fairly slow moving. That's the exact opposite of what private capital is looking for, which is a lower upfront investment and quick to scale. So that's why we decided to go as an go nonprofit.
And your initial focus has been on middle school. And it has been on math. Why was that the sweet spot?
Sure. Well, what the national data shows is only about a third of kids are leaving elementary school ready for middle school math, and less than a third actually leaving middle school ready for high school math. So you've got kids coming into middle school with these gaps. They don't know how to multiply or fractions that are really kind of getting in the way of their being successful. And if they leave eighth grade without the predecessor skills to be successful for algebra, their chances of catching up are very, very low. So what we thought is if we could come up with a solution that could really accelerate all kids, particularly those who come in behind, and get them ready for algebra, that would be where we wanted to focus our efforts.
Mm-hmm. So let's look at this from a student perspective. Let's say I'm your typical seventh grader. How is this going to work for me on a day-in, day-out basis?
Sure. So you're a seventh grader. You go to one of the partner schools we work with, and you have reading first period in room 206. You have PE in the gym second period. Mm-hmm. Third period, you have math. And instead of walking into room 105, you walk into what's typically a large open space with lots of different stations. In some stations, kids work with teachers. In some stations, kids work with software. In some stations, kids work with one another on different kinds of projects. And above each station, there's a sign. This is Columbia University. This is NYU, whatever the case may be. And when you walk in, you look up and you see a big TV monitor that looks like what you might see at the airport. And you see your name and you see which of those stations you're supposed to go to. So you might spend the first 30 minutes working with Mr. Smith in linear equations at NYU, the next 30 minutes working online with linear equations at Columbia, and then the last 10 minutes you take an online assessment in linear equations. And then you're off to social studies.
Mm-hmm.
That's your whole student experience. What we then do is we take the data from that online assessment and create a new schedule for you for tomorrow based on how you did today.
Oh, wow. That's unbelievable. how quickly will I get that schedule? Let's say I have a math class from 11 to 12 o'clock or 12:15 or whatever it may be. When would I find out where and what am I going to be doing the next day?
So the schedules are generally done by 4:30 local time. So we do about 10,000 schedules each day, all done by 4:30 local time.
Mm-hmm. How do the kids like this?
They love it. They like the mystery of what am I going to learn about today and with whom am I going to learn and where am I going to learn it. They love moving around. If you just think about how sometimes pretty boring it is to learn out of a textbook, this is a much more dynamic experience for them and, frankly, one they have a lot more ownership over. Mm-hmm. You know, they basically show that they've demonstrated they've learned a particular skill or concept, and that lets them move on. They have much more control in this environment than they did in a traditional model where the teacher is really guiding the pace and the content that the students experience.
So I can see it's just right size for them. In other words, I may not know something, but I'm going to learn it tomorrow, and this algorithm or whatever it is will indicate that I'm ready to learn that. So it won't be something beyond me, and it won't be something where my eyes will be glazed over because I already know it.
That's right. And if for some reason you don't get it after a couple sessions today, guess what? We're going to try again tomorrow in a different way.
Uh-huh.
Whereas in the traditional model, if you don't get the lesson that day, the teacher may just move on, and you're going to have that gap, and that gap's going to come home to roost at some point down the road.
Do the best students like to be challenged like this? Because pretty much it's all come easy to them, and now all of a sudden you set up a model where it's getting a little tough.
That's a great point, Denver. I would say many of them do. The ones that don't like to be bored love to be challenged. But yes, there are some that say, wait, I don't understand. Math was always very easy, and suddenly it's not easy. This can't be me. And in many cases, yes, they haven't been challenged enough. And so for some kids, being challenged is exactly what they need to learn. You know, the struggle is really where the learning happens.
Yeah.
And sometimes the advanced kids haven't necessarily struggled enough.
That's right. And then you have to deal with their parents, too.
We've had that situation as well.
Okay, Joel, how does this personalized learning model, where you're really meeting kids where they are, how does that square with this longstanding regimen of having kids meet grade level standards?
Yeah, it's a real challenge, particularly when you get to middle school. So the way school is organized is when you're in sixth grade, you learn sixth grade stuff and then take a sixth grade test. Then you go to seventh grade and learn seventh grade stuff and take a seventh grade test and so on and so forth. Well, when a kid walks into seventh grade on a fifth grade level, it may not be the best thing just to give that kid seventh grade material. You have to go back mm-hmm. and properly fill those gaps in service of getting that student ready for high school and ultimately ready for college. The tension comes in when the teacher says, well, look, our school, my evaluation is tied to the seventh grade test. So we really need to focus on the seventh grade material. When what's actually best for some kids is a mix of both grade level, pre-grade, in some cases, post-grade content to really enable them to accelerate.
Yeah. Would you like to see the way we do student assessment changed?
Well, there are a number of assessments out there right now that actually do measure growth from each kid's starting point to their ending point, and a number of schools use those kinds of assessments. We would argue those assessments are much better indicators of how students are progressing than tests that are just focused on sixth grade or seventh grade or whatever the grade level happens to be.
You know, when you talk about personalized learning, you also think of the different ways that children learn. You know, some like to be taught before they're going to do anything. Others like to dive in and then get feedback of what they've done. And, of course, there are, you know, preferable modalities for one kid in terms of the way they take in and retain information. Does this model allow for any of that?
Very much so. So there are nine different modalities, nine different ways that kids can learn and teach to one. Some of them are independent. Some of them are with teacher. Some of them are independent. There are nine different ways kids learn, nine different modalities. Some of them are independent. Some of them are with teachers. Some of them are collaborative. What the algorithm is doing each day is figuring out what are the different ways that seem to be successful for each kid and preferencing those approaches, not making those exclusive. If you're a student that doesn't seem to do well learning collaboratively, for example, we still want you to have some collaborative experiences, but we're going to preference those that seem to be the most effective for you.
Speaking of the algorithm, now you've worked with thousands of students in a whole bunch of different states, and I would imagine you have millions of data points. Have you been able to utilize that data in such a way to make the system even smarter?
We're just starting to do that, absolutely. And really, our core funders have basically said to us, we want you to play the long game. Don't worry about scale so much, but let's use the data you get every day to really crack this code. And that's really been our focus. So today, every student's schedule is based on their own history and a bunch of different business rules or academic rules, we would say, in our organization. But what will ultimately be is every student's schedule won't just be based on their own history. It will be based on the thousands of kids who've been in this exact situation. And how do we use all of that intelligence, even leveraging things like machine learning, to make sure that every student is positioned for success every single day?
How are you leveraging artificial intelligence?
Well, we're just starting to sort of begin to ask these questions. So how do we sort of use the data we gather every day to really recognize the patterns, to truly understand for this student in this situation, what does the data help to tell us about what will be most effective for each student? Some of that analysis we can do on our own, but some of it requires machine learning to sort of help us to recognize what those patterns actually are.
Where across the country is Teach to One currently being used, and how many schools are you in right now?
39. We're currently in 39 schools in 11 states across the country, everywhere from California to New York. We're in Oklahoma, New Mexico, Illinois, Georgia, serving just under 10,000 kids.
Have you been able to measure the impact of seeing the kind of academic gains students are making from this Teach to One?
We have, and there'll be some third-party studies coming out on that actually in the next few weeks. Each year, we're showing gains that are roughly 1.5 times the national average when we look at assessments that measure kids' starting points to their ending points, meaning if a student nationally gains 6 points, a student in Teach to One is gaining 9 points. We're also seeing even stronger gains for English language learners and students with special needs.
Fantastic. What's been the challenge to get into schools? I've talked to people on this show who said there is no greater challenge in this world than trying to get into a public education facility. But given those difficulties, is there anything that's particularly challenging of trying to get schools to adopt this model?
Well, I think there are a few barriers. The first barrier is the accountability systems, again, are based on grade level expectations, and our program takes a slightly different approach. The second barrier is cost. You know, schools are really organized to say, you know, I hire teachers, I buy textbooks. And this is just a different beast. And so finding ways to sort of help them find the dollars to support the adoption of early adopters is important. And I think the third is oftentimes in school districts, there's not as much of a desire for dramatic change. Many of the folks that are running the districts have themselves been successful in the old model of doing school, if you will. And so trying to sort of help people to understand there's a totally different way of thinking about this problem really requires identifying the early adopters that really want to go down that path.
Have you encountered any unexpected downsides to this, things that you never really thought would come up but just haven't worked the way you had hoped or maybe even have had a negative consequence?
I don't think we really foresaw the policy challenges being as much of a barrier as they have been. I think we thought naively that if we could demonstrate the kinds of gains we're demonstrating, more schools and districts would raise their hands. But frankly, many of them are saying, what I really care about is the sixth grade test or the seventh grade test or the eighth grade test because that's what the state's telling me I should care about. And the states say that's what the feds are telling me I should care about. And so that barrier has been one that has been more profound than we expected it to be.
You know, we talked a few moments ago about how students like the program and they like it. What about the teachers?
Yes, that's actually been one of the wonderful surprises about this this experience. So when we designed Teach to One, it wasn't only to design a better experience for kids. It was to design a better experience for teachers. Teachers are effectively in Teach to One co-teaching with their colleagues. One of my colleagues likes to say, you go from teaching as neighbors to teaching as roommates. So you're no longer the sixth grade math teacher or the seventh grade math teacher. You're a math teacher. You're in the space with four or five of your colleagues. All the sixth graders come in for math, then they leave. All the seventh graders come in and then they leave. Same with eighth grade. So it really requires teachers to collaborate much more deeply than they do in the traditional model, which is a fairly isolating job. And for the vast majority, that is a much better, more fulfilling experience, sort of work with your colleagues in this way. There are some that wish they just had their four walls and shut their door and could do their thing, that's for sure. But the vast majority will say this is a much more fulfilling role for them than the traditional teaching role.
I know that you are absolutely laser focused on making this Teach to One model better and better and better. But with that being said, what are your expansion goals? And do you ever think of maybe getting beyond just math?
We would love to one day. You know, when we started new classrooms, it was designed to both start with Teach to One Math, but one day look at other subjects and other grade spans. And it just can't be true that live teacher-led instruction organized out of a textbook is the best way to teach kids anything. There have to be other ways of integrating other modalities. So we'll be one day quite excited to explore what this can mean in other subjects and other grade spans. But for the time being, we really want to get math right. And then once we feel like we're pretty far down that road, we'll begin to explore that.
Let me close with this, Joel. The name of your organization is New Classrooms, and you believe that our capacity to design and implement a fundamentally different classroom is now within our grasp. What's it going to take to see that happen, not just in pockets, but across the nation?
It's really going to take a few things. Number one, it's going to take meaningful investments in R&D. That has really been the fuel for progress in nearly every other sector in our society, from telecommunications to healthcare to transportation. Fueling the design of new approaches to challenging problems is absolutely vital to this being a success. The second is the early adopters, is finding the schools and districts that raise their hand and go, we really want to be on the cutting edge of new learning models. Sign us up. We want to basically be the ones that are setting the trend for where this country can go. And the third is going to be policy, making sure that we have the space in our political systems and in our policy environments for schools to really do things differently that are really setting the stage for the future as opposed to just reinforcing what we've done in the past.
Well, very exciting stuff. Well, Joel Rose, the co-founder and CEO of New Classrooms and Teach to One Math, I want to thank you for being here this evening. If there are teachers or parents or students out there who want to learn more about this approach, what is your website and what kind of information will they find there?
Sure. www.newclassrooms.org. You can see videos, see more detail about how the model works, skill maps and learning progressions and some of the press we've gotten, as well as a way to sort of click for more information, and we can get in touch with you if you want to learn more and to explore whether this is a fit in your community.
Well, thank you, Joe. It was a real pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you, Denver.
And that is this week's show. Next week, my guest will be Rebecca Van Bergen, the founder and executive director of Nest, building a new handworker economy among artisans across the globe. Thanks for listening. Have a great week, and I hope you return next Sunday evening for the Business of Giving.
The preceding program is paid for by the friends and partners of the Business of Giving.
3-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.